Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
The podcast Slow Burn from Slate just wrapped up its latest season on the 1992 Los Angeles riots, which is known as the largest civil disturbance in American history. A video of police officers beating Rodney King was the spark that ignited civil unrest in the city.
Police in Los Angeles have begun an investigation into why some of their own men severely beat a man they had just pulled over. What those doing the beating apparently did not realize is that they were being videotaped.
The riots that followed also led to the exposing of corruption within the LAPD and the underlining problems of poverty and racial segregation in Los Angeles. Over the course of 8 episodes, Slow Burn host Joel Anderson provides a detailed look at the events that led to the uprising, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
You know, Joel, it's hard to believe the story of Rodney King and the riots were 30 years ago. What made you want to dive in deeper now?
Well, I mean, I think it really goes back to the third season of Slow Burn, which I also hosted. In the second episode, we cover how law enforcement all around the country, but particularly in Los Angeles and South Central, ramped up this like really aggressive police tactics against Black and Brown communities. And out of that, you know, that new style of policing, that new style of aggressive policing came the explosion and birth of so-called gangster rap, you know, the NWAs, the Ice Cubes, all that sort of people. And so as I'm in the middle of that podcast, the third season of Slow Burn, which is about the lives and deaths of Biggie and Tupac, I'm like, man, that is a really fascinating era. And so that's where the birth of this story comes from. And I know that like Slow Burn tells stories about the events of yesterday that tell us a lot about what's happening today, right? And there's absolutely an element of that. We're going through the so-called racial reckoning following the George Floyd incident. But and it has some real resonance, but in truth, I'd been thinking about telling the story for a couple years now, not even trying to time it up with the 30th anniversary or anything. It's just something that I really wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, this is interesting what you're saying here, because we often look at, especially when we listen to Slow Burn, it gives us a lens into where we are today. And in LA, poverty levels in South LA are worse than they were 20 years ago. There are continual investigations about conduct within the LAPD. In a lot of ways, what we're seeing mirrors 1992 in so many ways. What did the LA riots reveal to you about these larger issues within police systems?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're sort of an outgrowth of a lot of the broader societal problems we see. You know, you've got in South Central LA in the late 80s and early 90s, we're in the middle of a crippling recession. And in fact, in 1991, California, the state, lost 333,000 jobs, like in that 1 year, with 2/3 of those jobs are in LA County, and disproportionately are reflected in losses in those Black and Brown communities. So all these good jobs have slowly left the area. The area steadily becomes more impoverished. What was once a working class, middle class neighborhood becomes a poor urban one. And then you've got all the problems that sort of come with that, you know, drugs, violence, gangs, all that other sort of stuff. It's really concentrated. And then the police respond, right? Also, sometimes with the tacit approval of community leaders, people that want to see their streets safe or whatever, or think that they're, you know, the best way to deal with it is to ramp up policing and to lock up people. And so you kind of have that dynamic going on and on. And like, this is not, I mean, what I'm describing to you is something that is happening today, happened 30 years before that, and sort of was the pretext for the 1965 Watts riots. And so one thing that you learn is that like none of these things are just a coincidence. It's not just
mere happenstance. Incidents.
Yeah, they're all things that feed into that, that fuel these incidents long before you see the explosions play out on national television.
One other thing that you explore is Rodney King. You take the time to humanize him. You know, back in the early 90s, he was widely ridiculed after his beating by police. What is one thing that you learned about Rodney King that surprised you?
I think there's a couple of things. One, as I got started on this, I realized I just did not know a lot about Rodney King. As you mentioned, I thought of him as a joke. I thought of him as a punchline. You know, I'm looking at the guy and he's just like, oh man, this is really unfortunate. He seems really pitiful. But then you investigate and you look into the story, and I read his autobiography. And, you know, so there was a lot of push and pull after the video came out, right, that there were people in the community and people that had been working on anti-police violence efforts in LA that were like, this is the moment. We've been talking about LAPD and what they've been doing to us for decades. We didn't have proof. Now we've got proof. Here's the guy, Rodney King, right? And on the other side is Rodney King's mother, who was a Jehovah's Witness. And as part of that, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses, and if you're a Jehovah's Witness and I get this wrong, please, you can write in and correct me. But my understanding is that they are against political statement and that you should not make political, public political stances. And so when Rodney King is trying to sort out, you know, in this, I mean, he's just beaten almost to within an inch of his life. He has brain damage and he's trying to figure out what happened here and saying, I think they may have called me a racial slur. I don't know. His mother says, no, don't talk about that. I don't want you to bring that up because if you do, that'll just make it a controversy and so on and so forth. And so he listened to his mother early on. And I didn't realize, you know, people were very disappointed in Rodney King that he didn't show up for protests or he didn't speak out against police violence then or after, right? And a lot of that came from how he was raised and his mother. You know, there was a very powerful incentive for him to just do what he had been raised to do and taught to do, which is respect his mother and not speak up in that moment. And it could also be that, you know, just frankly, that Rodney King was just incapable of articulating the broader issues that led him to that moment.
Folks will have to listen to the podcast to hear how that happened. But I'm curious from you, how did the media's reporting contribute to this dehumanization of Rodney King? What are some lessons the media can learn from Rodney King on covering these kinds of incidents? And I'm thinking about our modern day coverage of cases where Black men are killed or harmed by police.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things at play. I mean, obviously the media could do a better job of not turning a victim into the defendant, right? And I mean, some of this is because those were the only public records that were available about Rodney King. He was not a guy like any particular distinction. He was a high school dropout who had had difficulty finding work. And the only thing that anybody knew of him is that he had been arrested and put in jail for, he'd robbed a convenience store with, I mean, it's sort of a goofy crime. It wasn't a violent crime, right? But that's what people knew of him, right? And so, in the absence of a victim that can speak for themselves, it would just be useful for people to remember that they are not, that the victims of these beatings are the victim of the shootings, right? Because now, you know, the videos we see, they're people that don't survive the incidents of police violence. And so humanizing them and thinking about how did they end up in that situation and the people that are attacking them or harming them, like, I would like to see more written about them and investigating, you know, does this department have a pattern and practice of abuse or police involved shootings or whatever. Like, that's the sort of stuff that I think would be more useful to humanize the victims rather than focusing on whether or not did they get arrested before? Could they have possibly have brought this on themselves? That was sort of one of the things that was missing, but that's, I mean, it's understandable how it happened, but it doesn't mean that we have to keep doing it, right?
One other thing that we're reflecting on and also examining is our language and the use of it. For instance, the word riot has come up as a word that we're interrogating at this time. Now that you've uncovered some of the systemic issues that contributed to the violence in LA back in 1992, is the term riot the best description of what happened?
I don't know that there is one all-encompassing term that gets the job done, because there are elements of what happened in those days in 1992 that are riots. There are people that are just looking for an opportunity to hurt people and take things. It's not wrong to say that it was a riot in some ways, that people went out to the streets and did things that they shouldn't have done. But that also doesn't mean that there wasn't like that there wasn't a reason for that as well. Like, there were people that were doing things that were clearly wrong, but they were also motivated in some part by the right reasons. And so I just think that people have to sort of take a nuanced look at it. Riots is just a shorthand, but we can investigate and interrogate that beyond that and figure out like the individual motivations and the individual factors that led to LA catching on fire.
You know, with every story that I touch, and especially stories like this, where you get deep into it as a journalist, you're an investigative journalist for all intents and purposes. What do you want people to take away from the podcast?
I want people to know that for us to get the sort of police reform that we want, it's going to take something different than what we've already done. And in 1992, there was some momentum. They're like, okay, clearly there's been some injustice here. We should do some things to course correct and get more control around the police department. But ultimately it devolved into, oh, we should build more businesses in these communities and give more opportunity. And they should do that. But that fundamentally is not what we were talking about. We were talking about whether or not LAPD should police Black and Brown communities in the same way that they police white affluent communities. And that's not something that they do. So more broadly, I just think that what I want people to take away is that if you think that police reform is important, and if you think that the policing that happens and this disproportionate police violence against Black and Brown people in this country is a problem, we're going to have to do something more than sort of nibble at the edges. It's going to have to be a fundamental rethinking of the relationship they have with those communities. But the issue is always, is there the willpower to get it done?
Joel Anderson is the host of Slate's Slow Burn podcast. Joel, thank you so much.
Tanya, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.